Okay, and we're live. Welcome back, everybody, to the Beis Medrash to do some learning together. The purpose of this shiur is to proactively address. I think a lot of the times when we talk about halacha, we talk about it in a reactive sense, meaning this happened. What am I supposed to do? But we really should be talking about it proactively also, so that I know what to do going forward, and also because we have a mitzvah. We have a mitzvah of Talmud Torah, and we should be doing things, and we should be learning about things, not only when there's a problem, but also so that we know what to do, and so we fulfill the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to talk about some of the practical Purim Shilas that I think are the most likely to come up, certainly some of the most common ones that I get as they relate to Purim, so that we'll know what to do on Purim, not only so that we can understand what to do if something goes wrong, but certainly that will be included in this as well. So we're going to talk about four common scenarios, four common shilas that come up on Purim. Number one, we'll talk about missed words during Megillah reading. Then we'll talk about speaking during the Megillah, or if somebody is speaking to you. Then we'll talk about, what's shaila number three? Shaila number three is what food for Shalach Manos is a very common question. We'll try to cover some general halachos of Shalach Manos also. And then lastly, we'll talk about davening, making brachos, benching when someone is intoxicated. And we'll talk about that at the end. Okay, sound good?
Sure.
Any questions? Okay, great. Hope there's no questions yet. We didn't say anything. So, okay, fine. So, let's talk about shaila number one, mistakes during Megillah reading. This, I think, is the most common, certainly the most common question that I get. And what we mean by mistakes in Megillah reading is that sometimes it happens, two things can happen. Number one is the chazan can make a mistake, meaning the chazan will say a word incorrectly, or the chazan will skip a word by accident, hopefully by accident. And sometimes it happens that the chazan says the right thing, and you just didn't hear what the chazan said, because someone was making noise, because there was a very aggressive Haman banger, whatever it is. It's not always easy to hear the Megillah, the entire Megillah completely. And so these are some of the things that are liable to go wrong, quote unquote, when it comes to reading the Megillah. Just by a show of hands, who here has had such a shaila before? They didn't know if they were yotzei the Megillah because of a noise that someone made, or because they thought maybe the chazan mispronounced something. Nobody? You don't remember? One person? Two people? Okay. Well, it happens. For some reason, I get a lot of questions about this, and I guess none of those people are here. But it happens very frequently. And the truth is, the shaila happens frequently because the situation happens frequently. It's very common that chazanim who are reading the entire Megillah will make a mistake despite their best intentions here or there. So obviously, we know that there's a mitzvah to read the Megillah, and we have to read the Megillah. But nevertheless, the Yerushalmi tells us, and usually we like to, in my shiurim, I try to go through the sources, what we call the Liba de Hilchasa, from the inception of the original Makorah, whether they be Pesukim or Gemaras, through the writings of the Rishonim, to the Achronim, to contemporary times. Today, because the format is a little bit different, what we're really trying to do is to understand some of the practical discussions. We're going to focus more on practicals, on questions in the here and now, and less on the evolution of the sugya, so to speak. But nevertheless, we're going to learn a Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi tells us in source number one, Ein medag degin b'ta'yoteha, that we are not particular about mistakes that occur while reading the Megillah. That's what the Yerushalmi tells us. The Yerushalmi hardly tells us anything else. But if you are reading that Yerushalmi, Yerushalmi says, Ein medag degin b'ta'yoteha. What do you think that means? When it comes to the Megillah reading, we're not particular about mistakes. What do you think that means?
Kind of relax.
What?
Relax.
What does that mean, we're relaxed?
No, not relax. It's lax. You know, it's not like the Torah reading.
Okay, so if you were applying this principle, what would you do differently?
Well, if you made a mistake, I would just go with it.
You just go with it. If someone makes a mistake when they're reading the Megillah, you could just go with it. Who thinks that makes sense? I don't want to put you on the spot. But Zach, you got to make some more friends.
Well, then why do we have the Gabbai up there?
So Ira's saying, well, it must not be the case because we have two people, usually, on either side of the Baal Kore, and their job is to correct mistakes. And people, yeah?
Well, how come the Yerushalmi says different?
Okay. So the truth is that it's an ambiguous phrase. It's an ambiguous phrase. Ein medaktikin tal yoteha, to what extent? Let's say the Chazan made a drastic mistake and he forgot to read the Megillah altogether. Is that considered a mistake? No, probably not, but where do you draw the line? So that's an interesting discussion in the Rishonim. This is a big machlokas. The Riaz, Rabbi Yitzchak of Vienna, who was one of the Rishonim, he died in the year 1270. He's most famous for his sefer on halacha called the Or Zarua, which is maybe something that you've heard of. The Riaz, Rabbi Yitzchak of Vienna, actually comments on this part of the Megillah in his Psakim on Meseches Megillah, and he says, this is what the Yerushalmi means. I'll tell you, it means, in source number two, V'im lo koran lo yatza ela ba'otiyot mafsidin et akriya. It applies whenever the words meet the, keep the meaning of the Megillah. In other words, when is it a problem that we don't actually return to correct mistakes, that we're not careful about mistakes in the Megillah reading? It's any time that they don't change the meaning of the word. However, if you make a mistake when you're reading Megillah, and it doesn't change the meaning of what you're saying, then it's fine. Then it's fine, and that's what the Yerushalmi means. So you forget a phrase, if you can still understand the thrust of the pasuk, that's not going to be a problem. If you omit a phrase, if you don't say anything at all, that's not going to that's not going to be a problem, as long as, and this is the key, as long as it maintains the meaning of the pasuk. And so therefore, you have to be a real bucky. You have to be an expert and to know what actually changes the meaning, what doesn't actually change the meaning. So let's say, for example, the Haman Nofel, Haman Nofal. Haman Nafal, excuse me. Let's say you change the tense from Nafal to Nofel, from the past to the present. Well, it's the same word, but it's a different conjugation, it's a different tense. Haman fell is not the same as Haman falls. So is that considered a change in meaning? Well, it's a good question, right? It can be a change in meaning. Technically, it changes the meaning to the present tense, but you can still understand what the verse is saying. So it's not clear, according to the Riaz, what exactly is considered a change that makes a change in meaning. And in fact, we'll get to that in more detail later. But that's what the Riaz says, and not too much later, by the way. I'm hoping this will not. I mean, it's always good to learn Torah for a long time. We'll hopefully be done by 9 or 9:15. I know that it's laid out, and people want to get home and
wake up early tomorrow.
You make up early tomorrow morning, potentially it's a fast day, so there's extra long davening. Okay, but the Rashba disagrees with this ruling of the Riaz. The Rashba says, no, I don't think so. In fact, the Rashba makes two comments. One of them is in his commentary on the Gemara, and one of them is in a tshuva. And the Rashba writes that V'davka b'ta'uyos shehalashon ve'inyan echad kigon Yehudim ve'Yehudiyim. When it says Jews, if you say it with an extra yud, it means the same thing. And so therefore, such a change will not be a problem. However, aval taur acher lo sheim kein lo korakula, because you have to read the entire Megillah. If you make another kind of change that does change the meaning of the Megillah, so then that is going to be a problem. It seems like he's saying exactly what the Riaz says, that if it's going to change the meaning, you're going to have a problem. If it's not going to change the meaning, then you're not going to have a problem. However, in his tshuvos, he adds another condition. And he says, well, that in the commentary in the Gemara, that only applies to a change if the Chazan mispronounced a word. However, if the Chazan omitted a word entirely, then even if the meaning of the word is intact, even if the meaning of the pasuk is intact, it's still going to be a problem. So what emerges from this is that according to the Or Zarua, according to the Riaz, whether you omit a phrase or you pronounce it wrong, that's all going to be okay as long as you preserve the meaning of the pasuk. According to the Rashba, we have to differentiate between omissions on the one hand and substitutions on the other hand, or mispronunciations on the other hand. Omissions are always going to be a problem. If you forget an omission, that's going to be a problem. In fact, Rav Eliashiv writes, someone asked him about this, I saw one of the contemporary Tshuva Sfarim, that even if you forget the conjunctive vav before a word, it's part of the word. It's just one letter. That is going to be a problem. That is an omission. That's going to be a problem. However, if it doesn't change the inyan, if it doesn't actually change the meaning of the pasuk, and it's just a substitution, meaning the chazan says the word, he just says it incorrectly, that's going to be fine as long as it preserves the meaning of the text. Okay, so you have two shitas basically similar. The Rashba and the Riaz both agree that if it changes the meaning of the word and it's a substitution, then it's a problem. Where they disagree is that the Riaz holds that that applies to omissions also, and the Rashba says that if it's an omission, it's going to be a problem no matter what. Okay, does that make sense?
If you leave out the word S, the Rashba says
it ruins the reading. That's what the Rashba says. Okay, good question. Does that make sense, that distinction between the Rashba and the Riaz? Okay. There is one other shita here, and it's the position of the Tor, and this is really sort of a phantom shita, or at least it's a phantom shita to me, because it's not clear who he's quoting. The Tor writes in source number 3 that the Yerushalmi says, "Ein medaktikim tatayoteha, v'yod mem," who knows what yod mem means, "yesh mefarshim, davka betaut ki hai shehaloshen v'inyon echad." He says, some explain this to me, and v'yesh mefarshim, and some explain this to mean that it only applies in a case where you don't actually change the meaning of the verse, which implies that the first part of his statement, ein medaktikin betal yoteha, means that even if it does change the meaning of the verse, any mistakes, as you said, Zach, are actually going to be fine. It's possible, some achronim try to say that this is the shita of the Rambam. It's not totally clear whose shita this is, but the Torah seems to say, because he just says categorically, he says, v'yesh, ein medaktikin betal yoteha. We don't correct mistakes, full stop. And some say this only applies to a mistake that changes the meaning, which implies that the first shita he was quoting applies to all mistakes. So it seems from the Torah that there's a third shita here. There's the Riaz that says if it doesn't change the meaning, it's fine. There's the Rashba that says also if it doesn't change the meaning, it's fine. But if it's an omission, it's always a problem. And then there's this phantom first shita in the Torah that seems to say that any mistakes are fine. It doesn't really matter what the mistake is, whether it changes the meaning of the word or it doesn't change the meaning of the word. All of that is going to be okay, seemingly, and some interpret the Torah's understanding this. So we have a three-way machlokas rishonim as to what it means that we don't correct mistakes in the Megillah reading. What's the halacha? So if you look in the Shulchan Aruch cites the same two opinions as the Torah. Source number six. Ein medaktikin betal yoteha. Some say we're not particular about mistakes. V'yesh omrim davka betaut shaloshim v'inyan echad. And some say that only applies to mistakes that keep the consistency of meaning intact. So what do we do with that? Shulchan Aruch has two opinions. Again, right? What's the first opinion of the Shulchan Aruch? Opinion number one is seemingly that all mistakes are fine. Okay. Opinion number two in the Shulchan Aruch is the shita seemingly of the Rashba that if it doesn't change the inyan, then it's going to be fine. If it changes the meaning, then it's going to be a problem. Then you have to go back. You have to say it again. There's other ways to understand the Shulchan Aruch. The Pri Chadash has a potentially different understanding. But to keep it as simple, let's assume that that's the understanding. So we have here three opinions in the Rishonim, potentially three, maybe two. And we have the Sheet of the Shulchan Aruch who quotes potentially two opinions. Again, Pri Chadash says maybe it's one opinion, but seemingly two opinions. So what do we do when the Shulchan Aruch quotes two opinions? It happens all the time. What do we do in the Shulchan Aruch? How do you know who to follow when the Shulchan Aruch says there's this one and there's this one? Ask your rabbi. So that's I'm always a fan of that answer. But that's an excellent question. There's actually a big machlokas about how to understand the Shulchan Aruch when the Shulchan Aruch actually gives two opinions. There's a big machlokas about this. Rav Avadja Yosef felt very strongly that you follow the first opinion in the Shulchan Aruch, but not everybody agrees with that. In fact, many, even Sephardic authorities, disagree with that. But in this case, again, some authorities like the Pri Chadash say that maybe the Shulchan Aruch is really only citing one opinion, and it's just one long opinion. And so therefore, practically speaking, again, I'd love to get into the lumdus of what the Shulchan Aruch means, but we need to know tachlis what to do. So practically speaking, so for Sfardim, who here, any Sfardim here? No, okay. What?
You say.
For Sfardim, the Yalkut Yosef is clear. We don't worry about it unless there's a mistake that actually changes the meaning. That's the psak for Sfardim. If it changes the meaning, it's a problem. If not, you're good to go. Okay. For Ashkenazim, it's a little bit more difficult. The Mishnah Brura and the Bir Halacha is not so conclusive, and he's who we usually look to in order to resolve these kinds of disputes. Mishnah Berurah and Bir Halacha is not so conclusive. The Aruch HaShulchan seems to write that b'di'evet, even a mispronunciation that changes the meaning of the word is fine, as long as you say the basic word structure. Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon, who was our scholar in residence about a year ago in February of last year, writes in his Sefer on Purim that the Halacha follows the Rashba, that in his opinion, any omission is invalidating, as long any omission is a problem. But if it's just a substitution that doesn't change the meaning of the word, then it's going to be fine. And that's also the Panini Halacha, Paskins, many Achronim Paskin this way. And so therefore, practically speaking, we would say both for Ashkenazim and for Sfardim, if it affects the meaning of the word, then it's going to be a problem. And therefore, when reading the Megillah, you have to know whether it's going to affect the meaning of the word. And that's very difficult. And in fact, the Chaye Adam actually writes that for this reason, because nobody really knows whether something, meaning people know, but it's very hard to tell whether something actually affects the meaning of the word. So therefore, the Chaye Adam says that you should always go back and read the Megillah again. You shouldn't say a bracha, because maybe it didn't actually affect the meaning of the word. You should try to figure that out. But because we don't know nowadays what affects the meaning of the words, you should always go back and read the Megillah again. That's what the Chai Adam would say, and that's what he says. But again, that's a little bit more machmir than some other poskim say. It pays to have Baalei Kriya who know when they've made a mistake, and it pays to have Gabayim and Rabbis who know when a mistake has been made, so that they can fix it. They can fix it for everyone. But that would be the halacha. However, if you find yourself in shul and you think the chazan made a mistake, so first of all, speak up. Say the word. Some people are very happy to do that. And just say the word. And then people will know to go back. If you have stage fright, you really can't bring yourself to say something. So you should bring yourself to say something. But another option here is to read it from your private Megillah and catch up to the chazan. That's what I generally, I've done it myself, and that's what I would advise, is if you find out that you're reading the Megillah and the Chazan makes a mistake, again, you should say something, but it's going to work to read the word that was mistaken from your private Megillah, and just if the Chazan goes ahead while you're reading it, so they just catch up to the Chazan and then continue listening with him. And the reason for this is because b'di'eved, as long as the majority of the Megillah was read from a kosher scroll, the reading is going to be considered valid. And so therefore, it's true, the Chazan mispronounced the word and you made it up from a non-kosher scroll. But again, the majority of the Megillah was fulfilled through a kosher scroll, and therefore it's going to be fine. That's the ruling of the Mishnah Berurah in the name of the Prima Gadim. So that's what you can do. Now usually, unless we have any Baalei Kriya here, the question is not what happens if the Chazan makes a mistake as much as it is what happens if I didn't hear correctly. And that happens a lot when there are kids around or when people are banging for Haman. So what happens in that situation? If the Chazan's probably said the right thing, but you just don't know because you didn't hear it. So some authorities are more lenient in that case. That's the truth. But generally speaking, we assume that the halachos carry over the same way. Meaning if you misheard in a way that affects the meaning of the word or the meaning of the pasuk, so then you'd have to read it again. And so therefore, what I would advise you to do is, again, most people don't have a kosher Megillah. If you have a kosher Megillah, then that's great. You can read along and you can make up the reading from a kosher Megillah. If you don't have a kosher Megillah, but you have, I don't know, let's say one of these things. So then read it from, this is Ruth, so hopefully you're not bringing this up. to Purim. But if you have one of those pamphlets, so what you should do is you should read along quietly until you get to the place where the Chazan made a mistake, and as long as you only do that for a minority of the Megillah, that's going to be enough b'di'evet to fulfill your obligation. You're not going to have to go to the late reading every year. right after Megillah reading, there are always a couple of very panicked questions. I don't really want to go to the late reading, but I think that I didn't hear anything. I came in late, etc., etc. So it behooves us to know what to do in a situation like this. Okay, let's go on to the next question. The next question now is going to take us much less time because we've already laid the groundwork. It's very similar to the first question. Second question is what to do if you speak during the Megillah reading. So it should go without saying that the Shulchan Aruch writes this, that in source number 9, Ein l'suach b'osha korinota, not proper to speak during the Megillah reading. However, let's say one did speak. So here there's a difference between if you're the chazan or if you're the listener. Anybody here planning on reading the Megillah on Purim night? So everybody, one person. So almost everybody here is a chazan. So if I say almost everybody's a listener, excuse me. Almost everybody here is a listener. Just wanted to make sure you're paying attention. So if the chazan speaks during Megillah reading, so again, it's not ideal, but let's see what the Levush says. The Levush writes in source number 10 that that this phrase of the Shulchan Aruch that you shouldn't speak during Megillah reading, Hani mili b'shliach tzibor, that applies to the reader of the Megillah. Shekorei sha'afi. If the chazan speaks, then they go back to the place where they were and they continue on. However, he says, "Aval hashomeya." If the listener speaks, "Imhusach v'akorei korei," at the time the person is reading the Megillah, "Harei hashomeya ba'odosach lo yishma lamasha korei korei." That the listener, if they speak while the chazan is reading the Megillah, so what's going to happen? Because they were speaking, they didn't hear what the person who was reading the Megillah said, and it's as if they missed the Megillah, and that's going to be a big problem. That's going to be a big problem because you have to hear the Megillah being read. We might get there. Just give me 2 minutes. So you have to hear the Megillah being read. And he said, "V'im kein lo shama kula ve'eno yotze." And therefore, you didn't hear the entirety of the Megillah, and one does not fulfill the obligation. And therefore, l'chein yizaharu kol hashomi misicha b'shas akriya. You have to be very careful if you're listening to the Megillah not to speak during Megillah reading. It's very, very important. 1 sec. The Mishnah Brura paskins this way. The Mishnah Brura writes the same thing in source number 11. That if you're the chazan, you shouldn't speak, but it's not as big of a deal. You just go back to where you were. But if you're the listener, and thereby you missed several words, then it's going to be a big issue. Now, two clarifications here is number one: in theory, it's only because your speaking prevented you from hearing the Megillah that this is a problem. But in theory, if you were whispering and you still heard and you were still paying attention, that's not going to be a problem. It's hard to tell whether that's actually the case because even a person's whisper right next to them is sometimes louder than the chazan's loud voice in the middle of the room or whatever it is. But nevertheless, that's the halacha. If you missed one word, so then you did not fulfill your obligation. Although number three is what kinds of foods to use for shalach manos. And there are a lot of different questions that come up about shalach manos. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, that one of the most common involves what kind of food should go in the mishloach manos. So let's go through some of the halachos. I hope that nobody's planning on giving raisins in their shalach manos this year. Because you know what it means. If you get raisins, it just means that that person got raisins and they regifted them to you. And now it's your problem to deal with and you're going to have to give them to someone else. But let's talk about what actually should go in the shalach manos. So the Gemara in Maseches Megillah in source number 13 says when it comes to Tani Rav Yosef Mishloach Manot Ish L'Re'ehu, this is a pasuk in the Megillah. What does it mean? Mishloach Manot in the plural, Shtei Manot L'Ish Echad, to a single person. U'matanos L'Evyonim Shtei Matanos L'Shnei B'nei Adam. Because Evyonim is in the plural, so you give two portions to two people, but Ish, when it comes to Mishloach Manot, is in the singular, so you give two portions to one person. And so that's, and if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, that's really all the Shulchan Aruch says in source number 14. Chayav lishloach lechavero shtei manos, basar o shnei minei ochlim, shenemar mishloach manot ish l're'ehu shtei manot ish l'echad. So you have to give two food items to one person. That is the minimum obligation of Mishloach Manot. That which people do where they prepare a bunch of bags and then everybody who stops by they give one to, or sometimes they go around the neighborhood giving to their friends. That's all. As long as you give one kosher Shalach Manos, so all of that is just extra, the cherry on top. So we're going to talk about that. So the Shulchan Aruch seems to just say, two portions of food, one person, you're good to go. And based on this ruling of the Shulchan Aruch, right, it seems like as long as you give one person two pieces of food, you're good to go. Shulchan Aruch doesn't put any limitations on what food that is. Shulchan Aruch doesn't say anything that the food can't be a drink, or it can't be a snack, or it can't be a candy. Seemingly, as long as you just give two foods to one person, doesn't matter the size, you are good to go. That would actually be the halacha. And this is, in any case, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't seem to put any limitations on the matter. And that's a little bit, for that reason, this psak of the Shulchan, any poskim add on all sorts of other qualifications. And the most relevant actually is a fascinating story in the Talmud Yerushalmi. Talmud Yerushalmi in source number 15 tells us the following story. Rabbi Yudan and Nasi Ashalach Rabbi Hoshaya Rabba Chada Itam Vachad Lagin Dechamer. Rabbi Yudan sent Rabbi Hoshaya for Shalach Manas. He sent him a thigh of meat or of chicken, something like that, and a pitcher of wine. So Rabbi Hoshaya sent back Shalach V'Amrele Kiyam Tabanu Matanos Le'Avyonim. He said to him, "You fulfilled your obligation of Matanos Le'Avyonim, the obligation to give gifts to the poor on Purim." Now the problem here is that Rabbi Yudan was not trying to fulfill the obligation of Matanos Le'Avyonim. He was trying to fulfill the obligation of Shalach Manos. So it's very disheartening to send a nice gift to your friend and have them send back to you what you did was good enough for Matanos Le'Avyonim, but it's not going to fulfill the obligation of Mishloach Manot. Nevertheless, what happened? Chazer v'shalach le'chad ogel v'chad gerev d'chama. So Rabbi Yudan up the ante. He says, okay, well, I'll send you an entire calf, and a barrel of wine. That's what he did. Shalach v'yamar le, so they sent him back. Kiyam tabanu mishloach manos ish l're'ehu. You fulfilled with us, finally, the mitzvah of Shalach Manos. So this is very strange, right? Because why is the first one not good enough? What's wrong about sending a thigh of meat and a flask of, or a pitcher of wine? So the Ritva writes, the Ritva has an interesting understanding in source number 16. We're not going to read it inside. But the Ritva writes that the first option was not kavadik enough. It wasn't good enough of a gift. It seems like for us that would be something that's very kavadik, to get some nice wine and meat. But that wasn't what it was. It wasn't kavadik. It wasn't respectable enough. And so therefore he had to give him something more respectable. A barrel of wine is much larger, it's more respectable. An entire calf is larger, it's more respectable. But what emerges from that, according to the Ritva, is that the Matanos, Mishloach Manot, can't just be any two foods. They have to be foods that are respectable. And in fact, it's for this reason that Rabbi Yudan was not Yotze the first time, because it wasn't considered to be chashuv. It wasn't considered to be respectable. Can I get to the end of the question and then we'll... Is it excellent question. So what emerges from this is that Shalach Manos have to be respectable. They have to be respectable. So if you put, your discarded pistachio shells and a half-drunken bottle of Coca-Cola, that's not going to work. It has to be. Respectable. And the Bi'ur Halacha, the Mishnah Berurah, and the Bi'ur Halacha quotes this lahalacha that the Shalach Manos should be respectable. He says in source number 17 that Af Shar Poskim Lo Hizkiru Davar Zeh, that other authorities besides for the Ritva and several others don't stipulate this condition. So maybe b'di'evet, even if it's not respectable, it's going to be fine. But lechadchila nason lizahar b'zeh. You should still be machmir, certainly lechadchila, meaning originally, to give something that is respectable. And therefore, what emerges from this is what to fulfill your obligation of mishloach manos. Again, if you want to put small snacks in your shalach manos, and give them to everybody else, that's fine. But to at least one person, you should make sure to give something respectable. And when we say respectable, poskim say, it should really be something that's fit to serve as the course of a meal. And so therefore, for example, if you send somebody a nice little small bottle of wine or something like that, and what's fit to serve at a meal, or some ravioli, or some sushi, or maybe I'm just have expensive taste, but or some challah and deli, something like that. That would presumably be enough to consider respectable. Assuming, again, ideally, that for both you and the person, if the person's going to just get a random pack of deli meat on their doorstep, it's not so. Maybe that's not so respectable. So again, it depends on the situation. But Blin Eder, I always try to give a meal's worth of food to that one person. So at least to one, and then we give out. We give out littler bags with like some snacks and stuff like that, and a b'di'evet that might fulfill the obligation. But I recommend that people just choose one person and give them something that's a real shalach manos, real food, real food. What else? And size wise, there's an interesting discussion. Meaning, let's say you give someone something very chashuv. You want truffles are very, very chashuv. I think, I don't know if we've ever had one. Truffles are very expensive. Anybody ever had a truffle? Some people. Is it all it's cracked up to be?
It is.
Yeah. So some people have but truffles. If you, one of those slivers is very small, right? So it's hard to say that that would be considered, even though it's very respectable, that would be considered considered enough. The Eshel of Rama Buchech seems to say it has to be at least a kazayis, but other poskim say it should be at least 3 egg volumes worth of food. So that's not so hard, but that's what poskim recommend. Okay, just briefly, let's talk about other relevant shailas for shalach manos. You mentioned whether the food or not has to be edible. So some say the food must be already cooked. Some say the food has to be cooked. In fact, if you send a raw chicken, that's not going to be valid. Some posts can say, well, as long as the chicken is shechted properly, that's going to be good enough because they can turn it into a meal. Everybody agrees that if something like a canned corn or something that you can just twist off, that's obviously going to be okay. The pre-chadash, even if it's raw, the pre-chadash says you can send it. That's not so relevant nowadays. Are you sending people raw chicken? In the right, so anything that's edible in its current state is going to be fine. What about 2 drinks? Can you give 2 drinks? So again, it could be 2 very respectable drinks, but maybe it's not a meal. So some poskim say that it's fine. Others disagree. L'chadchila, we try to be machmir to give 1 drink and 2 foods, or just have no more than 1 of those foods be considered to be a drink. What about a husband and wife sending joint shalach manos? Meaning, does each spouse have to send their own shalach manos, or can they do a joint one? So the Magen Avraham writes that a woman can't be yotzei with her husband; she has to send her own. She has to send her own shalach manos. That's what the Magen Avraham says. Others disagree. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach said that they could do a joint shalach manos, but it has to contain 4 foods instead of 2, because each one is including each spouse's shalach manos. Rav Avadji Yosef is even more makel. He says that you can send from one husband and wife, can just send 2 foods and have it be from both of them. Presumably, in all of these cases, Rav Shlomo Zalman makes this case explicitly, you have to make sure that the recipient knows that it's from both of you. Because the whole point of shalach manos is to engender goodwill. So the person needs to know who it's coming from so they can have that sense of goodwill. So if you are going to fulfill shalach manos with two spouses are going to do 1 shalach manos together. So again, it depends on how you hold in this machlokas, but there's room to be makel. What about children sending their own versus being yotze with their parents? So the Aruch HaShulchan says, obviously, if the person's over bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah, so then they have to send their own because they're chayiv and mitzvahs independently. Under bar bat mitzvah is not going to be necessary. The Tshuvos Kinyan Torah says that if everything that the child has is still considered to belong to their parents, then they can be yotze with their parents, shalach manos, it's no problem. But if the child actually has their own possessions, then the child has to send their own shalach manos. Okay, the last shaila, we'll do this just in 2 minutes, is davening and benching under the influence. Now, it's usher to daven after drinking. It's usher to daven after drinking, even if you're not drunk in certain cases. The Gemara differentiates. Does anybody know the source for the prohibition to daven while drunk? Not Birkas Kohanim. Hana is accused of being drunk by Eli Kohen Gadol. And we see from the way Eli Kohen Gadol responded to her that he accused her of being drunk, that being drunk and davening is a problem. And so therefore we know that one is not allowed to daven drunk. But there are three levels when it comes to, maybe four, when it comes to how drunk you are and how that affects things. The first is, I hope nobody ever reaches this state, is what we call shichruto shelot, which means you're so drunk, like Lot was in the Torah, that you're actually putter from all mitzvos. You're exempt from mitzvos when you're so intoxicated. That doesn't really happen very often. Hopefully it should never happen. The other one is just straight up drunk, what we would define as not being able to speak before a king. If you're not able to speak before a king in a respectable fashion because you're giggling or whatever it is that you do when you're drunk, everybody's a different kind of drunk. But if that's what's happening, so then it's usher to daven. Then it's usher to daven, and even b'di'eved, the davening is not going to be valid. Let's say you had less than that. Let's say you're a little bit tipsy. So then you're still not supposed to daven, but b'di'eved, the davening is going to be valid. And so you have to know on Purim which category you're in. If you're drunk, you should use your judgment. You should use your judgment to figure out, you know, what kind of person you are and whether or not this is appropriate for you and what to do. When you are drunk, I will say that even according to those who can't daven, you can still and are obligated to, unless you're as drunk as Lot, and you're not obligated in any mitzvos. But if you're drunk, you're obligated to recite brachos before eating food, for example, after using the restroom. You're just not allowed to daven, Shmona Esrei. But other brachos you are obligated to recite. When it comes to Birkas HaMazon, the Mishnah Berurah says that it's best to say benching before you start drinking if you feel like you're going to be drunk for benching. But if you didn't do that, then as long as you're full from the meal, we should bench anyways. If you're not sure how drunk you are, you're not sure if you're fit to stand before a king, so generally we would say don't daven, and probably don't get drunk. There's another discussion here about whether or not to get drunk on Purim. We're not going to talk about it. But if you're not sure, some poskim say that on Purim you can be lenient to daven, because some poskim say that there's no prohibition on Purim to daven while drunk, because how could Chachamim have said, so according to some opinions, that you should get drunk Nevertheless, so therefore the halach would be that you're allowed to daven drunk on Purim. That's pretty out there, I would say. That's not such a common shita. But nevertheless, if you're a besafek, the Panini halacha, for example, says that you can assume that it's fine. So where this all leaves us, just to summarize, is that when it comes to mistakes during Megillah reading, if it's the kind of omission that changes the meaning, if it's the kind of mispronunciation that changes the meaning, so then everybody agrees that that's a problem. And what you should do to fix it is read quietly from the Megillah until you catch up to the, read from your private Megillah or pamphlet until you catch up to the Chazan. The same would apply to speaking during the Megillah, although we should really try hard, especially if you're the listener, not to speak during Megillah reading. When it comes to number three, foods for Shalach Manos, so we spoke about a whole number of Shilas, we're not going to go into all of them now, but in terms of what's on the source sheet, they should be respectable. They should be respectable things that are fit to serve a person at a meal or for a meal. And lastly, when it comes to davening drunk, so it's usher to daven drunk on Purim. If one has had less than that amount, so then if they can speak before a king, they can technically daven b'di'eved. Although obviously it's best to have all of the alcohol out of your system, and many would argue that it's best to not drink at all on Purim. I personally think that's a personal question that has to be discussed, maybe in consultation with the rabbi, depending on your family history and your situation and your tolerance levels. I think in consultation with your wife. But I think that answers some of the more common shilas about Purim. So I hope that this answers some questions that you have or some questions that you're going to have. And I'm happy to stick around if there are other Purim-related questions, but it's already 9:14, which, as I said, we'd end by 9:15. So we can wrap it up here for now.